This is Professor Carlson, and this is the third part of our lecture for October 23rd. When we left off, we were about to talk about the so-called unfair labor practice strike. This is a strike not in support of economic bargaining demands, but to object to illegal behavior by the employer. We've already suggested on a number of occasions that it makes a difference whether a strike is unfair labor practice strike or economic strike. And we're going to look at that more carefully in the next set of slides. Let's advance now to slide number 28. Unfair labor practice strikes a right of immediate reinstatement. Now, an unfair labor practice strike is a strike that is either caused or provoked by the employer's unfair labor practice. And here I have to add a little bit to this bullet that I wish was already included there, but you'll have to jot it in your notes because this is important. A strike can begin as an economic strike, and it can be converted so that when we talk about an unfair labor practice strike, it can be one caused by an unfair labor practice strike, provoked by an unfair labor practice strike, or converted from one thing to another by an unfair labor practice by the employer. Now, the Mastro Plastics case that we studied earlier covers a lot of ground. It's a heavily edited case, and one of the other aspects of this case is the Supreme Court's holding that an unfair labor practice striker, in contrast with an economic striker, an unfair labor practice striker is entitled to immediate reinstatement upon the conclusion of the strike. And by conclusion of the strike, I mean that the strikers have decided to go back to work whether they've achieved a good result or not. Now, that means that the employer must lay off strike replacements if necessary, including those who received offers of permanent employment. They have to be laid off if necessary to make room for the returning unfair labor practice strikers. Fourth bullet, again, we can't emphasize this enough. A strike that begins as an economic strike can be converted to an unfair labor practice strike. And so you can imagine that it's frequently the union's basic strategy in a strike, not only to hurt the employer's business by the withholding of services, but to seize upon any opportunity to declare that the strike is no longer an economic strike, it's an unfair labor practice strike, because at that point the employees are protected from being permanently replaced. But whether any individual striker enjoys this advantage depends on the point in time at which he was replaced. Was he replaced before the conversion or after the conversion? So the right to reinstatement depends, number one, on the date on which that conversion happened, and number two, the date on which that particular employee was replaced. Obviously, it's going to be difficult if we have a handful of replacements and a larger number of strikers. How do we know which of the strikers was actually replaced as of a particular date? And ordinarily, since seniority will govern in the labor context, seniority will help us resolve that problem. We assume that the employees or the strikers with the least seniority were likely to have been replaced first. Let's advance now to slide 29. Here we have a practice problem. Take a moment to read that problem and then pause this while you're reading and then turn it back on again when you're ready to hear the answer. Well, let's sort this out mathematically. What happened initially was that the employer replaced 20 of the strikers on the original offer of employment to new applicants. And that was perfectly legitimate. The employer had the right to hire replacements. And so the 20 of the 80 strikers were replaced at that point. But now the employer starts to become a little bit desperate. He says something that he shouldn't have said. He threatened to fire anyone who didn't return to work. But as we've warned before, the use of the wrong words can result in an unfair labor practice. If the employer had simply said, "I'm going to continue to replace you permanently," As threatening as that is, it's not an unfair labor practice to declare one's rights under the law. But to say that you will be fired is to say that you're going to do something that you can't lawfully do under the law, to fire such employees. So that everybody who's replaced after this point is now the equivalent of an unfair labor practice striker, or at least that will be the union's theory, that on that date when the employer made this threat, suddenly they weren't just striking for economic demands, they were protesting the employer's unfair labor practice. So you can imagine the union's going to be on the lookout for occasions like this to declare the conversion, and overnight their signs will change. They won't just read striking for better terms, they will be reading in protest of an unfair labor practice. Now, this means that at the conclusion of the strike, 20 strikers who were already replaced are in fact permanently replaced. Five who were replaced after the conversion are going to immediately get their jobs back, even if this means that the employer must lay off some of those replacements. Let's advance now to slide 30. Clear Pine Moldings comes back to a problem that we discussed earlier in connection with economic strikes, but again, we're talking about an unfair labor practice strike. What happens when there is exuberant activity on the picket line? Will the board be any more forgiving of unfair labor practice strikes? Another way of putting this problem, does one wrong excuse another? Let's advance to slide 31 and talk a little bit about the Clear Pine Moldings case. It's another instance where we could recite a lot of history that leads up to current law. We're going to cut all of this short and just talk about what remains the prevailing precedent for the board. And this is true even under Democratic administrations. It's the Clear Pine Moldings case. How do we deal with the misconduct of unfair labor practice strikers? Remember that misbehaving strikers and picketers may be unprotected and thus subject to discharge. Now, the early NLRB tended to be somewhat forgiving, particularly in the case of unfair labor practice strikers. It held that they might be excused for this kind of exuberant behavior. They would, in essence, balance the severity of the employer's unfair labor practice against the employee's actions. And in some instances, this led to the reinstatement of people who'd done some pretty awful things, but then the argument in favor of reinstatement was that the employer was pretty awful as well. The modern board, since Clear Pine Moldings, has tended to reject that approach. They're not as forgiving of employee misbehavior. The modern board approach, therefore, has been that we still judge the employee's activity for what it is without really any regard for the severity of the employer's unfair labor practice. Now, again, it's not always easy to reconcile board decisions, and I have to say, we're not just looking at the unfair labor practices of the employer. There are all sorts of things going on the picket line, and you can imagine many instances in which the employer, or its supervisors, or foremen, or private security guards, or strike breakers and replacements, engage in behavior which is in and of itself provocative, and that might be a defense for the employee. Let's advance now to slide 32. Sympathy strikers supporting other unions. Now we're shifting gears again and dealing with a third kind of strike, a so-called sympathy strike. Here's the problem. Even if an employee's own bargaining unit is not on strike, he may confront a picket line of another bargaining unit. Now, it might be a bargaining unit at the same workplace. He's a member of a warehouseman, but it's the factory workers who are on strike. Does he cross their picket line or does he not? Maybe he's a delivery driver, and it's his job to deliver or pick up goods at a factory that's having its own strike. Does he cross that picket line? Now, for a lot of people in the labor movement, the answer has tended to be pretty simple. You don't cross a picket line. It doesn't matter whether it's your own or someone else's. And in my experience, it's a part of this culture that we don't really question the purpose or the merit of a picket line, you just don't cross a picket line. Now, even that is subject to some further qualifications. Is it a union associated loosely with yours? Is it a member of the AFL-CIO, or is it a member of some other association of unions, and so on? So we don't have time to go into all of the nuances of what may or may not be a culture of the labor movement. Suffice it to say that you will have occasions in which people will simply refuse to cross a picket line because that's their way of showing solidarity with the labor movement. Now, in general, we treat such sympathy strikers as economic strikers, which means the employer, subject to all of the rules that we've talked about, can't fire them simply because they've engaged in this kind of concerted activity. But remember that the sympathy strikers' own collective bargaining agreement might prohibit such a work stoppage. So we have contract issues that we have to resolve. Does the no strike clause apply to sympathy strikes? And clever unions will negotiate the no strike clause to permit their members to observe certain other picket lines. Again, this is all a matter of bargaining and drafting. It's an important issue for both sides to look at in preparing their collective bargaining agreement. Now, if we treat the sympathy striker as an economic striker and his sympathy strike is not in violation of his contract, the consequences are these. The employer can replace him. And that's a pretty simple matter, of course. If the sympathy striker is refusing to cross a picket line at his own workplace, he is, you know, full-time unavailable at his own work. It's been much more complicated when we're dealing with people like, say, a delivery driver who refuses to make a delivery at one particular place. Should he be replaced full-time because he refuses to make a delivery at a particular location? And the law in this area, again, remains fairly unclear. You could make the argument that the employer doesn't have to replace him as long as we can find at least one other delivery driver who can make that delivery. But the law, as I've said, is not altogether certain on this point, so that either the sympathy driver himself is at some risk of finding that his conduct in retrospect was not protected, or the employer is at some risk in finding in retrospect that the conduct was protected and it was unlawful to discharge him or even replace him, for that matter, for failing to cross that picket line. Finally, I can't emphasize enough, a lot of this is going to be addressed by the collective bargaining agreement itself, if there is one. But we're getting close to the end now. Let's advance to slide 33, union enforcement of employee participation in the strike. What can the union do besides having a picket line to encourage its own members, at least its own members, to observe the integrity of the strike? Let's advance to slide number 34, takes us to the NLRB versus Chalmers case. Can the union fine its own members for crossing the picket line? Let's advance to slide number 35. In Aulis Chalmers, the employer in this case is the charging party, it's the union that has fined employees for having crossed the picket line. Obviously, all of these employees that were fined were not just employees, they were actual members of the union, which was the basis of the fines. Now, unions can also expel members for violating the rules. It's worth a moment to consider whether expulsion is sufficient to deal with this problem. And the answer is no. If a member has decided to cross the picket line, he has many other worries aside from expulsion from the membership to worry about. And probably the threat of expulsion is not severe enough to prevent people from making that decision to cross the picket line. So if we're going to grant the union the right to enforce the picket line by its membership rules, a fine would be a much more important threat, particularly if the fine can be more than the employee could hope to earn by crossing the line. In this case, therefore, the union sought by judicial lawsuit to collect fines ranging from $20 to $100 against these non-strikers. And the basis for the union's claim against the members was that they had breached their contractual obligation. The employer, more or less the surrogate for the employees, files an unfair labor practice charge against the union, alleging that it has coerced or restrained employees in the exercise of Section 7 rights not to join a union or not to participate in collective bargaining activities. Let's go on to slide number 36. Enforcing member duties by state court action. All of this is based on a contract theory of membership. One's charter and bylaws are one's contract with all of the other members and with the organization. And one very likely provision of a union's bylaws would be do not cross our or certain other picket lines. Obviously, a non-member is not bound. Thus, you can imagine a situation in which you have people who are members of the bargaining unit, but they're not members of the union. And this is one of the key distinctions. They are not bound by any contractual obligation to observe a picket line. The penalty in most union bylaws for violating the picket line rule is expulsion from the union and, as in this case, the assessment of fines. Now, what happens if the union also expels a member from the union? Well, we learned much earlier in this course that even in a union shop, the employee is not going to lose his job, because when we ask whether or not he is a member of the union in accordance with the collective bargaining agreement, membership has to be based or seen as something associated merely with the payment of the agency fee or the amount of the dues that is owed. If the member is expelled for any other reason, such as violating a picket line rule, the union shop arrangement will not result in his loss of employment. With that in mind, the expulsion and fines are not quite as oppressive as they might otherwise be, and the court holds in this case that a reasonable fine is not a violation of Section 8B1. Now, there are other ways that members might violate their rules besides crossing a picket line, and there have been separate cases and separate issues about the enforceability of fines. What happens if the union fines a member from filing an unfair labor practice charge against the union, or worse, petitions for the union's decertification? In general, the courts have ruled that the union cannot retaliate against members by expelling them or assessing fines for filing unfair labor practice charges against the union. In the case of filing a decertification petition, there's some merit, obviously, in saying if you want to destroy the union, you can't really be a member of us. On the other hand, the prevailing view is that the union is not permitted to assess a fine against an employee, even a member of the union, who seeks the union's decertification. And now we really are getting close to the end. We're ready to advance to slide number 37, the Pattern Makers League. Raises the question whether the union can avoid the possibility that union members will avoid fines by simply withdrawing from the membership. Wouldn't that be an easy and clear-cut way of not having be exposed to fines? In the Pattern Makers case, the strike had already begun, and the strike had continued for much too long when several members decided to resign as a prelude to returning to work. They undoubtedly realized that they wanted to resign so that if they returned to work, they wouldn't be exposed to the assessment of fines under any kind of a contract theory. But this union has foreseen this kind of problem, and its rules not only prohibit crossing the picket line, they also prohibit withdrawing from the membership at any time in the midst of a strike. Obviously, the union is anticipating what the employees did in this case and trying to prevent people who changed their minds from withdrawing from the union just before crossing that line. In any event, one could object that this kind of rule interferes with an employee's right not to be a member of the union, but the court upholds this measure as a legitimate internal union affairs matter. Once you sign that oath, you are bound by the obligations to observe that picket line, even if you change your mind later on, and that, after all, is the essence of a contract. Now, once the strike is over, you can withdraw. The truth is, I think this would be the truth, that you could withdraw your membership in the middle of the strike, provided you don't cross the picket line. It's not so much a matter of requiring your continued membership as your promise not to cross the picket line. Well, let's advance now to our last slide, NLRB versus Curtin Matheson. And it's one more reason why unions have to fear the consequences of a failed strike, because sooner or later, after a failed strike, you are going to face a decertification petition. And let's think about how the numbers are going to turn out. Aside from the fact that you may have lost the support of many of your members, you have to remember that now there are non-strikers and permanent replacements who also work for the employer, and it wouldn't be surprising to learn that many of them are not sympathetic toward the union. Now, that in and of itself is troubling for the union, because these people will be voters in any subsequent decertification proceeding. But secondly, and it gets worse, because as a result of a Taft-Hartley-Landrum-Griffin Act series of amendments to the Act, Congress was very concerned about unions going on very, very long, lingering, but unsuccessful strikes. And to make a long story short, just imagine a situation in which the strike is unsuccessful, but the strikers can't or won't go back to work. Perhaps, you know, they've been replaced. There's no reason for them now to end the strike. Maybe they found some other sources of income. Could they go on perhaps even for years and still regard themselves as employees? And this is an important question, mainly because they might or might not be eligible to vote in any subsequent election to determine whether or not the union has majority status. So the rule under the current version of the Act is that economic strikers, and again, we're only talking about economic strikers here, they lose their right to vote, they lose their eligibility to vote after 12 months if they're still on strike. Now, you can imagine what's going to happen if we've had an unsuccessful strike. That means we have no contract, there's been no recent election, and therefore there's no bar to a decertification petition. Either some of the replacements or non-strikers are going to file a petition, or the employer perhaps can claim a reasonable uncertainty of the union's status. Now, if the employer files this petition, can the employer rely on nothing more than the fact that it has hired a number of replacements and that many employees have crossed the picket line? And the answer is no. We adhere to a presumption in favor of non-striker support for the union. Now, this is perhaps counterintuitive, but there are policy reasons, perhaps more than factual reasons, why we follow this rule. The employer cannot file a petition that's based merely on its assumption that replacements don't support the union. And this is perhaps to discourage the employer from just packing the workplace with replacements and transferees. So the employer's petition will have to be based on something else, other evidence of non-support. Or, as frequently happens in these instances, the replacements or non-strikers find out how they can initiate their own petition. And then we're still going to face that problem. They will file the petition. They'll have the necessary showing of support. And it may be that the sympathetic union supporters, the strikers, will suddenly find themselves outnumbered. and that is the conclusion of this lecture for October 23rd.